This is Mae Brussel. It is World Watchers tape number 854, April the 25th, 1988. Last week on World Watchers, April the 18th, I talked about the National Alliance and William Pierce, who took over the American Nazi Party, changed its name to the National Alliance, and how their group had bought 100 shares of AT&T and hoped to influence the board of directors at their annual meeting in Denver, Colorado, that would take place April the 20th. One day after I made the tape for you, on April the 19th, there was an obituary in the papers all around the country. The president and former chairman of AT&T passed away very suddenly. James E. Olson, 62 years old, passed away. He'd been operated 3 weeks before for a colon tumor. One obituary said, and they, of course, added, all of us in the company are shocked at the suddenness of Jim's death. Another obituary said Mr. Olson's deterioration was rapid. The company said the cancer was diagnosed after he became ill and had the flu March the 18th. With the flu, they did surgery and 7 days later removed a tumor on the colon. A similar three-week cancer is that of Jack Ruby, who was all puffed up and swollen, and his sister saw him in the cell, and he was sending notes out of the Dallas jail that Lyndon Johnson and the John Birch Society were behind the murder of John Kennedy. And 3 weeks later, he was dead. He was taken to a hospital right away and had cancer. The diagnosis was cancer. The meeting in Colorado was described in the Wall Street Journal, not a total success for the Aryan Nations, but on the other hand, they made a little headway there. The Wall Street Journal said that Mr. Allen, the new president, he was appointed immediately after Mr. Olson died, within a day, was presiding over the meeting, and he spared any major controversy at the annual meeting, despite a rally against racism by the local 777 and the proposal of the National Alliance to stop hiring blacks was voted down. The Wall Street Journal said the National Alliance proposal did guarantee that blacks would be hired, that the vote was 6% for recommitting AT&T to affirmative action. That's 6%. But there was a proposal that got enough votes to make it be resubmitted next year in the proxy. And Mr. Allen said that AT&T at times tried to block the National Alliance, but they weren't successful. So next year they will have another vote on the matter. The reporting of the meeting was on national television, and also there, I have a copy of a report in the San Francisco Examiner, April 21st. And this said that the stockholders attending the company's annual meeting voted down by an even larger motion. They voted down against stopping the hiring of blacks. But by an even larger margin, a resolution calling for the advancement of more women and minorities in management was voted down. We lost one battle, but the war has just started, said Herbert Poinsett of Norcross, Georgia, who came on behalf of the National Alliance, the Nazi group, and he wants to get the vast majority, he said, of white people in this country to wake up to see that they are being displaced by people who shouldn't be taking over their jobs. So he did have a victory of a sort where they can hire minorities and women, but they can't, on the other hand, be advanced. They're calling for a resolution to stop the advancement in the management, and that seems to have gotten a good sound boost from the various people from AT&T. So next year they will be back again doing the same thing until we have a real good depression, and then wait and see. They'll yell, "I told you so," and it will be like Germany, where the Jews were taking the jobs away from the Germans at the time of unemployment. The Monterey Herald had a story April 17th, freed prisoner calls on judge. The mastermind of two of Italy's most sensational post-war scandals made a courtesy call last Friday on the judge who ordered his release from jail. Licio Gelli said, "I want to thank the magistrate who, by granting me provisional liberty, has given me back my life." Antonio Pizza, who ordered the provisional liberty, was one of the persons, the judges, who charged Jelly with fraudulent bankruptcy in 1982 with the collapse of Banco Ambrosiano, Italy's largest private bank. And the judge was visited by Lucio Jelly to thank him for letting him be free, out doing his thing on the streets. The Los Angeles Times had a story this week, past week, which has been suppressed except in the Monterey, not the Monterey, the Miami Herald. This is the story that I had on World Watchers 840, January the 11th, 1988, on the Health Maintenance Organization and the people behind Miguel Ricciari Jr., Jeb Bush, the son of Vice President Bush, Lynn Nofziger, John Shears, the who's who of a lot of political heavies on the East Coast. And this was having to do with the Medicare system, the international medical centers under the control of Mr. Ricciari, who has left the country, taking a million or more behind him. And the danger of this particular operation that I called attention to had to do with giving medical care and contracts for thousands of Haitians that were put into the medical center here down in Florida, and they handled Cuban refugees and 10,000 automatically enrolled families. And I thought of the potential of AIDS and the sinister connections, which I'm going into more with the main subject that I want to put on this tape for you. But the LA Times has a story, April 18th, former White House aide Lynn Nofziger played a key role in a private health firm's multi-million dollar lobbying campaign to loosen federal regulations protecting Medicare patients. And this article tells how Lynn Nofziger was lobbying in Washington and received $40,000 for the lobbying. And I mentioned before, Lynn Nofziger is a business partner, or was, owning real estate with Helene Von Dahm, the mysterious Helene Von Dahm from the Reagan administration in California, and then appointment secretary in the White House. And he's been close to her, and Lynn Nofziger has been directly linked in the Watergate period to the American Nazi Party, and hoping to get their votes and working with them. And Von Dahm, his partner, has always been a mystery person in relation to how, as appointment secretary, many of these people got jobs in the Reagan administration that are turning out to be so corrupt now. Of course, obviously, she wasn't fit to make these appointments, but they're very fit to cover them up. So the Los Angeles Times has a story mentioning Jeb Bush and Lynn Nofziger. It's not a wire service story. It's only in the LA Times, April the 18th, but I think it's interesting that they at least have it, which is more than most of the newspapers in the country should have, and it should be making the headlines all around the country. What did make the headlines this week were stories about the material being released on the Robert Kennedy assassination. Of course, one of the headlines in the San Francisco Examiner is Los Angeles police destroyed RFK evidence, and another one burned RFK evidence called superfluous. And then there was a disgusting meeting in Los Angeles put on by Paul Schrade, a man who was actually shot in the Ambassador Hotel. And it was a meeting for a reunion of friends of Robert Kennedy. The subject was RFK Remembered. It had nothing to do with his assassination. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. was there. It was held at Loyola Marymount University. And alleged friends of Robert Kennedy, including his daughter Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, Frank Mankiewicz, Cesar Chavez, Tom Hayden, and so forth. And Paul Schrade put this together. He said it's a victory of life over death, but I believe the killing of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy is a victory of death over death, because this country started turning backwards in 1963 and 68, and it has gone downhill ever since. In fact, Mr. Schrade was angry that March Fong Hugh, the Secretary of State of the state of California, released these documents on the Kennedy assassination. He wanted her to hold them back till the conference was over, because he didn't want any conversation about the situation of the murder of Robert Kennedy. It really makes you wonder sometimes where these people's heads are at. And I'm not going into all the details of those files. A lot of it was in the newspapers, and I may update it for you later. But many of you are new listeners and don't remember. It seems like yesterday to me. But I wrote an article on the Robert Kennedy assassination, a short one, for Midnight, that small newspaper that gets out like the Star and the National Examiner and so forth, called Nixon's Pals, the CIA Linked to Robert Kennedy Assassination. And across the top says, evidence of investigator reveal startling information. This is the one that I wrote for Midnight, a short article. I do want to get a book out of all the articles I've written, and some of these I haven't shared with you on the air, or I did it a long time ago. Many of your subscribers going back to 1976, but for the new ones, most of you are new. I just want to run through, because this is the bottom line on the Robert Kennedy assassination as far as I'm concerned. We know the evidence was destroyed and witnesses were killed and others are silent, such as Paul Schrade, etc. But this is the real story. Who is behind the people who are the selected patsies? That is always one of the big, big stories. What I wrote is that the web of illicit CIA activity has routes that are tangled with the relationship of Richard Nixon that spread from the John Kennedy to the Robert Kennedy assassination. Sirhan didn't kill Robert Kennedy alone. The chain of events that brought him to the United States from Palestine and put the gun in his hand implicates many people. I wrote, it started in Palestine, where American agents within the Greek Orthodox Church gave money to the Sirhan family. This is the same conduit that brought Marina Oswald to this country and that serviced her needs in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. They funded the Sirhan family. This funding continues once people get to the United States. It doesn't end, and they were brought to America. It involves a well-to-do California husband and wife who sponsored their passage to this country. The wife, the study claims, is the sister of an old college friend of both Richard and Pat Nixon from their days at Whittier College. In the 1950s, the couple also moved in the same social circles as in Pasadena as their senator, Richard Nixon, and the Sirhan families to move to Pasadena. I said then it may all be coincidence, but you can't overlook the way the family traveled and asked some questions about it. I said that in 1976 and 1988. I don't believe there are many coincidences. And I referred to, after the Watergate investigation started opening the Senate investigations into the CIA, revealed by those and by President Ford, that the CIA infiltrated the churches. And I believed it was time to reopen the Bobby Kennedy assassination just based upon the conduit of the churches and these people, how they ended up in the cities where they did, given the acts that they've been charged with. From early accounts of the Sirhan family, they were a poverty-stricken family that were driven from their home during the Arab-Israeli War in 1948. It is also known that the Sirhans were steady churchgoers. They were Lutherans in Palestine. They belonged to a Lutheran congregation. But in 1956, they strangely changed their allegiance and joined the Greek Orthodox Church. And immediately after, the family fortunes improved, and they were making plans to move to America. Now, put in the time slot of what I was writing then, 12 years ago, in 1956 is when Otto Skorzeny, who worked for the CIA, was setting up the Middle East operations, not only in Egypt and Libya, but working through the whole Middle East. Skorzeny worked for the CIA, worked with the Reinhard Galen operation that was involved in the Dallas-Fort Worth and Pasadena part of these assassinations. And all of a sudden, this church switch causes them to get tickets for the family to America. Sirhan Sirhan was only 12 when they arrived in New York. The father stayed on in Manhattan. The mother and the three children went to California, where she worked as a domestic. Two sons joined them later. According to the New York Times, the father worked as a plumber in New York City. He found himself a good job also in an East Coast defense plant. They had really hardly anything in Palestine. They were dirt poor. But the papa starts working in a defense plant in New York. Either way, I wrote, it seems odd that an alien could suddenly get a job in a defense plant and that he could come over here and get right away into the plumbing union, because this is not only a highly competitive field, but it's almost impossible to break those family-held union ties, building union ties in New York City. Meanwhile, out in Pasadena, Sirhan's mother purchased a home. She was able to buy her own home, a modest house, but considering the supposed poverty of the family, they owned the home in Pasadena. The father worked as a plumber and also in a defense position in New York. Then there was a link between bringing the family here, the Greek Orthodox Church, and the CIA. I asked, was there a link, or as they're quoting me, as the investigator said it, Are these people sleepers, I asked, that would be used years later? A sleeper is a person planted in a community for the purpose of espionage. And I said, I know there are sleepers all over the country to be used later, often years later. It's like the police departments and the FBI use men who have prison records. They keep them out of jail so long as they perform, but they have a leash on them if they fall out of line. It is interesting that the Sirhans, originally of Jordanian origin, were never in this country given their citizenship. They still haven't got it. They didn't have it by 1976. They can always be deported if they make a mistake. Further evidence that the Sirhans received a payoff of some kind can be seen in the case of the father. He stayed in the United States 1 year, sent the wife and sons to California. He never rejoined them, but went to Jordan. He never worked again. The Los Angeles Times said he lives in one of the town's most substantial stone houses. He owns a 50-acre farm and two other residences. And Sirhan's father, this gentleman, just passed away this past year. In Pasadena, even stranger things were transpiring. The New York Times reported that two families were responsible for getting the Sirhans to America. One family, a doctor and his wife, were identified in the press. The other couple have never been publicly named. They're probably the Otto Scorzini team, but they were never named. By the time of the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the church in Pasadena that supposedly helped finance bringing the Sirhan family over here had been completely torn down. The doctor and his wife were both dead. The two people that brought him and the other couple never identified have disappeared. In fact, nothing was heard about the missing couple until a writer named Ken Kelly spoke on a San Francisco radio station, KSAN, in April of 1976. He claimed that this mysterious family were prominent in Pasadena society, active in the Republican Party, and in the Rose Bowl Committee, as was Richard Nixon. They were closely related to the college friends of Pat and Dick Nixon. They attended Whittier College together. They double-dated together, and one of the women was Pat Nixon's sorority sister. Sirhan's mother continued to work and worked for them as a housekeeper up until the time of the assassination. The FBI interviewed the sponsoring family after the assassination, but this never became public record of any kind. And I'm sure that must be among the 2,400 pieces of paper that have been destroyed, burned, that they said wouldn't be any use to you. There are many, many more missing links to the Sirhan story. I wrote, for example, the U.S. Department of Justice was able to pinpoint Sirhan's entrance into this country on an alien on permanent resident status, but the Jordanian government never heard of him. They were supposed to have come from Jordan, and the Jordanian government had no record of them. At the Jordanian embassy in Washington, Dr. Walid Saadi, counselor, said there was no record of Sirhan there or in the Jordanian consulates where Jordanian nationals are registered. And I asked the question, were the Sirhans unknowing patsies for the CIA, and said it is plausible. Sirhan could be used. He was a natural. Our intelligence agency looks for people who have other motives, so it will never appear that the agency is involved. And remember what was at stake here in the elections in 1968 was Richard Nixon, who was supposed to win the election from John Kennedy in 1960 and didn't. And then Nixon's presidency opened up all the dope and narcotic traffics that started flowing into this country with the Southeast Asian War and the mafia from the east and west, both ends, flooding this country with narcotics, among other things, and escalating the Vietnam War. So that the election of Robert Kennedy, replacing his brother now in 1968, was a very pivotal year. And so you wouldn't want this to appear as a political assassination. I said Sirhan would have a motive for the appearance of violence or for violence. He did shoot four people in the Ambassador Hotel. As a young boy, he had seen a friend of his blown up in front of him, and he had seen all the trauma of the Israeli-Arab conflict. He could be used. Many former emigres from communism, such as Castro's Cubans, people from the Greek Orthodox Church who escaped from Stalin's Russia, were used for political assassination teams and cover-ups for domestic intelligence operations. Even when the CIA planned to assassinate foreign leaders, they went to the mafia so it wouldn't look like the CIA was involved. When E. Howard Hunt needed a team to break into Watergate or into psychiatrist Daniel Ellsberg's office, he went to the CIA, and the CIA gave him the name of a Cuban locksmith, Martinez, Gonzalez, and Sturgis. They didn't give them a locksmith in Washington. They would make it appear the Cuban. And it was a Cuban, but it happened to be anti-Castro Cuban. And I said in this article, why did they do that? Because they have the mentality that if they're told the Cubans are giving money to the Democrats or to Daniel Ellsberg, they can say it is a communist. And the others will say, I hate communism. I was kicked out of the country by communists. Therefore, I'll break into those offices. This same type of situation existed with Sirhan. He went through the trauma with his best friend blown up, and these things stay with you all of your life. So if you say a Jew did the blowing up and Bobby Kennedy is giving money to Israel, you've got a natural motive for a cover-up. And I went on to say that it's possible to hypnotize Sirhan to forget what he did, who funded him, and who's behind him. You can erase his memory. And then I mentioned the Senator Frank Church's committee, the evidence on the use of drugs and amnesia on unsuspecting people. What is amnesia, I asked, but forgetting process. And Sirhan doesn't remember very much. To this day, he still asks to be taken to the Ambassador Hotel to see if his memory can be refreshed, but they won't let him. And I concluded by saying he sits in Soledad Prison, probably for life, the alleged loan-crazed assassin. And I always faulted Bill Turner and other people working on the Robert Kennedy assassination because they never wanted to go into the background of the Sirhan family, and it was directly linked to Pasadena, to Richard Nixon, to the intelligence community, and the change of residence, their ability to fly from Palestine that in Jordan right into Pasadena, the hard home of Richard Nixon and his cronies and the Lincoln Club and all that goes with it. And the father then buying a home back in the old country and the mother buying a home here and being very comfortable until Sirhan in college, who has an anger towards Israel and the violence there, can be used as a sleeper. And the bottom line, I believe, in that story is how they got here, just as the bottom line in the John Kennedy assassination is, what were Lee and Marina doing in the Soviet Union? How did they meet? Why did the Greek Orthodox Church and John Tower sponsor her getting here, etc.? So that's, I think, the most potent and important part of the Robert Kennedy assassination. And no single researcher except myself ever brings it up, thinks about it, or wants to confront the conspiratorial aspects and the way they go back the roots to those matters. Now, speaking of conspiratorial matters, I'm going to share with you an article. You may get it at the library. It's from Barron's Magazine, the National Business Financial Weekly, published April 4th, 1988. The title is Rogue Justice, Who and What Were Behind the Vendetta Against Inslaw. Inslaw is a contract, a company that got a contract for the Justice Department. Now, a long listener to World Watchers sent me this article, and I read it yesterday and outlined it. It took me 6 hours to outline it into 14 pages. That is a lot of intense concentration. I can't put it on one tape or two. I may put all the other news aside and just make the next tape and the remainder of this on this particular article. Why is this article important? For many, many reasons, and one of them, of course, is that it encompasses all the conspiratorial aspects of what I've been trying to say on World Watches for the past 17 years. You have to read it, and you can't read it fast, and you have to understand the many, many implications, and I'll share them with you and put them on the sheet and outline part of it for you with the sheet that accompanies these tapes. But you have to concentrate on what this article is saying, and I'm going to do it with you. The two of us can do it together better than you can do it alone. It covers biological warfare and what I think it may be the seed money for financing the AIDS project. It involves turning the total justice system into a police state. It has to do with moles in the Justice Department that were beginning to be set as soon as Daniel Sheehan began to get his case together and file a civil lawsuit in Miami under and with the Christic Institute. It has to do with the Justice Department manipulating and purposely breaking corporations, because if they did it to one, they've done it to other, breaking a corporation, not wanting, allowing bankruptcy, but liquidation, and having the person who will receive it waiting like a basket for a basketball to come into it. It involves the Alameda Mafia that I've detailed on World Watchers for years. It brings up questions that I had at the time of the Meese confirmation hearing that are now in the news, such as that company Hadron and the ownership of Hadron, and the portent of the IRS becoming a police state branch of the Justice Department. There's so many implications here. I often take a book and read the last chapter first, or see a movie and want to know the end first. That's a trait of a Gemini. But I want to just start this broadcast, this part of it, on Inslaw with the conclusions of what happened, because this involves what happens to inventors or scientists when somebody else is waiting to take over their inventions and steals them from them, either takes the corporation completely, and in some cases I've known of medicated, drug them, control them, kill them, brain experiment on them. This has to do with greed and power, but it doesn't come out of other offices of the government, like immigration or even the military or health, welfare. And it doesn't come out of the other departments. It comes out of the Justice Department. So it makes justice a contradiction, such as military music or whatever. There's no justice there. And the stranglehold that Reagan Meese have on the Justice Department is forever. It is part, I believe, of that thousand-year Reich, of the effect of Otto von Bolschwing in California with Von Dahm and Reagan. It is horrendous. Now, I'll just give you a couple of references or quotes at the conclusion of the article, then we'll go into the beginning and end up with the conclusion later. A man, an attorney named Charlie Doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, was the attorney for Inslaw and for a man, Bill Hamilton, who owned this computer company that got a contract with the Justice Department. And Charlie Doctor, the attorney, was talking about the IRS, and the IRS is brought into this case, and the Justice Department wanted to squeeze this man out for vindictive reasons, for pure profit, for police state and everything. Charlie Doctor said, regarding the IRS position, he said the whole thing smacks of a police state, and this scares the hell out of me. This is Barron's National Business Financial Weekly. This isn't some hokey-pokey little leftist, you know, neurotic person worrying about that police state. He said the whole thing smacks of a police state, and it scares the hell out of me. Scary is the word that is used by the victims of this entire Inslaw affair. The article was written by Maggie Mahar, M-A-H-A-R. In fact, when I complete this tape, I'm going to write to Barron's and congratulate her for this brilliant article. People like this don't write very often. It reminds me of the quality of Jeff Gerth when he wrote about Resorts International and Richard Nixon and William Rogers and that whole combine that he did in Sundance Magazine at the time of the Watergate hearings. Scary, as I say, is the word used by the victims. They are angry. They are hurt. They can't believe what happened. The Justice Department engaged in a vendetta to end the career of a federal judge. They got him fired. They bankrupt a company. The justice engineered all this. They forced a partner out of his own law firm. They caused another federal judge to recant his story under oath. And they reached down and wrecked the career of a 21-year government service employee. They said they would set him loose with a recommendation if he shut his mouth. And this story also has to do with the resignation of six people March the 30th regarding Edwin Meese's affair, and it turns out that these people had to get out, evidently because this story was closing in on them. They didn't resign because Meese was going to be prosecuted. They left for another reason. Now, along the lines of this story and part of it, not separate, is a article in the Wall Street Journal called The Near Totalitarian IRS, because this material on Inslaw goes into the IRS. And this is written by David Power, April 15th. that the IRS employees are using networking computers and have virtual freedom through the most fearful agency in the United States. They are operating a near-totalitarian system. They have the power to unilaterally order the seizure of a person's property or garnishing of his income. The person has hardly any rights other than to pay for the deficiency. And this article, I'll just begin with it on the other side of this tape, and then get into the story in Barron's magazine, Rogue Justice, Who and What Were Behind the Vendetta Against INSLAW. So we'll start with the IRS and then get right to that story.